aspects of romance, if it is all the aspects of infatuation and chemistry, it is a spectacular poem. And if you ever get the chance, or you do have the chance to read it, go and read it, because it is actually a beautiful, beautiful poem. You see, poetry, and a lot of people don't get this and why poetry is so difficult, is poetry is supposed to make you not think as much as feel. But you have to think to get to the feeling, if you know what I mean. Because you have to read the words, and the words have to mean something to you so that you might be able to enter into it. So as an exercise today, we did have a reader, but what we're going to do is we're going to read together. Okay? And how we're going to do this is in the following manner. We have a screen like this. Can anyone kind of read this? Maybe position yourself in an area that you can see it properly. Is that if it's in gold colored, oh, thank you, I'm going to ask the women to read. If it's in white, that's me. I'm the friend. Friends. I'm going to pluralize myself. If it's in, where is that? If it's in green, I'm going to ask the men to read. Okay? So it's pretty simple. So gold is for the women, blue is for the men, white is for the friends. That's me. I'll play that role. Oh, thank you. So men are green. Women are gold. And me is white. Okay. So I'm going to ask the women to begin for us. And oh, actually, there's supposed to be one other heading here. It's called the Song of Solomon's Song of Songs, which is the title of the actual book. Ladies, I don't know how you... we read just the first chapter and the last chapter, chapter 1 and chapter 8. I don't know if you already sense the sensuality of this poem, the sensuality of the Song of Songs. Because it is not just about... the actual images, they're not looked at as objects. They're meant to evoke feelings. The sense of how it feels. For the friends to adorn this woman, you know, with cedar or with shields. Like with power, with beauty, with stature. Or for the man to say, your eyes are like doves. I mean, whose eyes are like doves? If you really think about it, this is not how poetry works. If your eyes are doves, you can't see, right? And it looks really freaky, like unbelievably weird. But what it is that what do you feel when you see doves? They're beautiful. They're graceful. They flutter. And that's what her eyes make him feel. And the perfume, it includes all the senses of what you see, what you feel, what you smell, what you taste, all of these senses. And this is what makes it sensual. Not in a negative sort of, you know, lewd sense, but in a beautiful, a real sense. It reminds us that we are humans, that we are sensual beings. It reminds us that we are humans, made to understand what feelings are to feel like, what longing is like. And this is what the Song of Songs is about. So where I like to begin is where the song pushes into. And that is, it asks the simple question, what is a person worth? What is a person worth? Well, I actually looked it up. The human body, if broken down into its attendant elements, is worth $18 at the basic, and up to $160 if you're able to extract 100% of everything. The likelihood of you actually being able to extract that much is pretty negligible. So most scientists, if they're just looking at you from the elemental table, go for the lower number. Even that is considered high, like twice what some people say it was about 20 years ago. More recently, in 2005, I believe, or so, they did the Wired magazine did a sort of expose on how much a human body might be worth on the black market or in the organ trade. In the organ trade. So, just to let you know, a person does not survive this, okay? There are some that you can survive, but a lot of it you can't. But you are worth up to 46 million, and this is US dollars, so in Canada, probably 60 million. But this is what your organs would cost if you were in tip-top shape. And of course, not going to survive the process. But eyeballs, and these are kind of low comparatively. I mean, kidneys go for quite a lot. Your DNA goes for quite a lot. If you were able to extract all the marrow, all the from your bones, it's actually about $23 million. But that's if you're able to extract. So this is hypothetical. Pretty hypothetical. Although some of these are organ trade sort of numbers. So $46 million. But you will be absolutely dead. Here's another number to consider. In human trafficking, a person is worth $90 US. That's how much a person costs to be sold into slavery. That is the global average price. What a bargain. You can have 6 slaves instead of a new iPhone phone. Actually, an old iPhone. And that's quite unfortunate. But this is the cost, the price, the value of human life in our world today. I guess if you're looking at the $46 million, it puts a new spin on feeling like $1 million, $1 million bucks. But this is a very grim reminder. But aside from the physical, let's not look at the physical, the elements. If you're sold into slavery, what is a person actually worth? Well, what we're actually talking about here is self-worth. How do we value ourselves today? And among the most successful, we've discovered that most are afraid of being found out. To be not as expert as they claim to be. They're not as successful or not as good as others think they are or treat them. And so therefore those who are successful, or even those who are successful, especially those who don't feel like they're successful, even though people look at them as they are, they constantly think that we need to be better, stronger, richer, smarter. We need to be more famous. We need to be more athletic, more skilled, so that we can have higher value in the eyes of others. On the outside, we tend to inflate ourselves. Or some tend to inflate themselves. And it comes across as a form of arrogance. And in fact, that bluster covers up a real anxiety that is inside. And this problem is perpetuated by our merit-based society. We are rewarded according to our abilities. Which then leaves those who have physical or developmental challenges in the dust. Well, it is understandable why that meritocracy is in place. You don't want a bad teacher to teach you. You don't want an ignorant plumber to fix your pipes. You don't want an incompetent doctor to be operating on your heart. You don't want a negligent accountant doing your books. You don't want a foolish pastor giving you bad advice. Competency, effectiveness, knowledge, wisdom, and passion are important and even lauded in Scripture. While apathy, complacency, immorality, sloth, and foolishness are eschewed and rejected. But where does this place us within the tension of both excellence as well as accepting ourselves of value? You see, the question that Song of Songs really challenges us with in its story is the question of, what am I worth? Or more specifically, am I worth loving? And by loving, I don't mean mommy and daddy loves me. I mean romantic love. That when someone sets their eyes upon me, when they get to know me and think about me, would they give themselves up for me? See, my definition of love is a little bit different from what might be often used. What's happening here is the Song of Songs is the erotic, sensual, and realistic portrayal of what we sometimes call romantic love. There's one thing I want to note here as we go forward. This book is known as the Song of Solomon, or Solomon's Song of Songs. It's traditionally attributed or associated with him. Whether it's something that he commissioned, something that was given to him, or something about him. You have to realize that when you read this, and when Israel read this, and still read this today, Solomon had a harem of over 1,000 wives and concubines. 1,000. How jaded do you think he was? And yet, under his name emerges this poem about love between one man, one woman. Did Solomon, and this is the question, did Solomon, despite all the women and sex and power and wealth, in his heart of hearts, long, really, even in himself, for true love? Did he long for someone who would love him for who he was, not for all the power and riches that he had? Despite all his success and worth, being among one of the most powerful rulers of his day, did he long for something that no money, no power could bring him? And perhaps this poem is a reprimand to him, or a warning from him of what a broken heart longs for. With all the beauty and power of this poetry, it is really just the longing. We don't know, but these are questions worth considering, given that his name is associated with this poem. On the other hand, a lot of people think of Christians as prudes. And I can't say that they're entirely wrong. There are parts of our tradition where we like to wear black robes and try to look as ugly as we possibly can. Some other Christians go to the other side and really don't care and want to portray a sexy, cool face. The reality is, the Bible sees sexuality as a divine gift. But like all divine gifts, it warns about its rampant abuse. In other words, sex is good in the right context. But sex is hellish in an unhealthy one. Also, the Song of Songs is for both the married and the unmarried. It is for those who long to be loved. The reality is this. You can be unmarried and loved. And that's an exciting part of life. But also, sadly, you can be married and unloved, which is the reality. So let us begin to explore a little deeper. Put a little bear away, wondering whether he or she is worthy. Here's where we want to begin. This is where the Song of Songs helps us. Herein is the wisdom. When we're thinking about self-worth, our value is derived from who we love and who we are loved by. Our value is derived from who we love and who we are loved by. Our value comes from who we are devoted to and who motivates us. Worth is therefore attributed or given. It is never taken. How do we talk about this? Notice that the key here is who we love and not what we love. You see, loving a thing or an idea is a disaster. To have inordinate love for money, for fame, for sex, for sports, for work, for play, for video games, for booze, for drugs, for power, for influence, gambling, entertainment, and so on, leads to unhealthy passions and addictions. To love and be devoted to those things, to things, is to be enslaved by them. To worry and think about things chains us. Now, not all of these things are inherently bad, unless they become a primary passion and pastime. The problem with our use of language is that we use love and hate pretty off the cuff, right? So we can use the phrase, I love chimichangas, next to the phrase, I love my spouse. It's the same word, love and love. But they're completely different contexts. You don't love your chimichangas the same way you love your spouse. And by the way, if you don't know what chimichanga is, it's a Mexican food. Those of you who enjoyed it, I enjoy mine. I like them fried. Which is what chimichanga is. The word love, unfortunately, in our culture has become a fairly cheap and throwaway word. You can love lots of stuff. And I find it easy, actually, to talk about the things I like. The things I love. So we talk about the Super Bowl. I can talk to you about how I love martial arts. I can talk to you about how I love, playing video games. Or how I love watching movies. Oh, I love movies. But what is difficult to talk about is who we love. And we don't talk about it often enough. You know why? We can talk about food. We can talk about pastimes. We can talk about movies. But those really don't matter to us. When we begin to talk about people, that is a level of intimacy that cuts quite deep. So if you say, oh, I really didn't like Star Wars, something wrong there. Or you might be like, okay, that's annoying. But you're going to go, yeah, it's just too bad. You just don't understand. Or something like this. But if you say, I don't like your father. Whoa, dude, don't go there. Your mama, so, you know what I'm talking about. That's where that trash talk comes. The mama talk. Because it really cuts deep when you're talking about someone you love. Because you don't love Star Wars like you might love your husband or your wife. Or you shift it to anything, I don't know. Or your mother or your father. And so it is more difficult to really talk about people, but that's where the action is. That is why we love people, persons, not things. And the Song of Songs is all about that. The Song of Songs is focused on a person, always. She always speaks of him. And when she speaks, it makes us uncomfortable. Because it's such intimate talk. It makes us feel like we're voyeurs. But it's not nasty talk. It's not dirty talk. It is beautiful speech. The Bible is trying to help us to recover our eroticism. Recover our humanity. The way in which we speak about who we love. But have forgotten to. Or afraid to. Because those whom we love also cause us anguish and pain. Even in the best ways, when they are absent. A person who is truly in love is truly in anguish when the other is not present. And that's what this is about. For most of this poem, they are apart. For most of the poem, she's looking for him. For most of this poem, he's looking for her. His speech is about her. Her qualities. What he sees. How he feels about her is focused on a person. There is passion. There is desire. There is longing. The so-called object of devotion and desire is a person with a mind. A person with a past, with a history, with a family, which they speak about. The family, the brothers, the sisters, their social settings. This person has a soul. And they are absolutely unique. And you love them. And this leads us to what I see as three particular perversions of sexuality. That Song of Songs moves against. The first one is probably the most rampant. And that is objectification. It's taken by the photographer, Roger Weiss, in a series called Human Dilations, in which he distorts the human body as he photographs them. What we're talking about in objectification is this. That you objectify a human person into a commodity, into merely body parts, for selfish, sexual use and exploitation. This is the corruption of pornography. This is the corruption of sex trafficking in all its forms. Is there a soul to the people in porn? Of course there is. But is that what you think about? Do you think about how these girls or these boys, these men, these women get there? What they're addicted to? How they are misled? How they are deluded? Do we think about the abuse? In our country, there has been a back and forth about legalization of prostitution or how to handle prostitution. And yes, there's people who sell themselves because that's what they do. Who say that it's okay because they want to do it. But there is another voice that says, we do not want to do this. We have been exploited by pimps, by sex traffickers. But they have no voice because they have no voice. When we reduce the human body, male or female, only to its parts, only to commodities, to make ourselves feel better, or for sexual use, in porn, in prostitution, no one cares about the soul of a person. No one cares about their mind. No one cares about their story or their life. It's about immediate gratification. And we reduce the human person to a commodity. Song of Songs never does this. Ever. There is always the person before them. The value. The story is always there. About the brothers. About the family. About the social encroachment, about the king, even about Solomon himself. They know the reality that they live in. And they see each other. Objectification will destroy us. The second perversion when it comes to sexuality is fantasy. Or a fantasy ideal of love. Can you tell what is real and what is not real? I mean, I picked these things. Most of these are spoofs, but they're pretty interesting. And some of them are real. These two books, these two magazines are spoof ones. This is a spoof, the Blind and Buttonless Horseman. I don't think you can read it here, but he never watched where he was going because he couldn't see. And then here's 50 Shades of Grey. It says, women in real life, 50 Shades of Grey. Women in real life relationships, 50 Shades of Grey relationships end up dead in a woman's shelter or on the run for years. This is what we fantasize about in our society. This is what gets popular. It's like the images and magazines and books. Now, what is so dangerous? It's just a harmless fun. Everyone needs to be valued or wanted. In the longing for this, in a world that tends to objectify, it's hard to be known as a full person. So what happens? We become enamored with the idea of being loved. The fantasy of being wanted or desirable. Both men and women, although it happens differently. What happens here is that in relationship, that relationships then are started with real people. But the form of expectation and excitement only lasts a certain amount of time. People, quote unquote, fall in love as if it was an accident. And hit it off with good chemistry and infatuation. But how long does the fantasy last? You know what I like to say? The old adage, everyone is normal until you get to know them. This is true of dating. Or even marriage. So when the shine fades from the relationship, the glossy front page covers, when our fantasies and expectations in a relationship are not met, the relationship, if it's only sustained by fantasy, begins to decay. And what we're left with are broken hearts, broken marriages, shame, guilt, and a hardened and jaded heart. Philandering begins to happen. Broken families, blended families, promiscuity. You know, in a relatively recent movement, people have been learning about the detrimental effects of pornography and fantasy. The fantasy is solitary. The fantasy is alienating. It is self-absorbed and it is empty. It is the act of masturbation. And yes, there is momentary pleasure, but you are still alone. It is incomplete. It does not fulfill what is in the soul, but is a caricature of what God intends. I'm not going to comment on the rights or wrongs of these things. These are just the realities. Psychologically and internally. But these things create such a fantasy that people begin to realize that no one can ever match up to the fantasy. It literally becomes impossible when you're involved or addicted to sex or porn specifically. It becomes impossible to have a relationship, a healthy relationship, a real relationship with another human being. This is because the biggest and most important sexual organ in your body is not below the belt. It is above the neck. It's this thing right here. What you think, how you see, how you feel, how you perceive. And this is why it's so important. The Bible teaches us to guard our thought life, to guard our desires, to guard our God-given desires. It is healthy to have a sexual libido. It is healthy. If you didn't have it, you need to see a therapist. But what you do with it, what you do with your desires, is what's important. Whether it be anger or fear, what you do when you're angry or afraid determines the person you are, controls your life. What you do with your sexual feelings, which are God-given, are also determiners. You are meant to love a person, not a fantasy. Those of us who married already know this. Some of us who aren't married have already encountered this and realized this. A person is not to be treated like a disposable cup at Starbucks or Tim Hortons. Real love, true love, not chimichanga love, is tenacious and lasts beyond the novelty of fantasy. It is grounded in reality. The third and final perversion of sexuality is fear. Given everything I've talked about and how dangerous it can be and how sad and painful, some of us can be so damaged, fearful, ashamed, and guilt-ridden, we give up. We give up. We cannot risk giving ourselves away. And so we might actually even embed ourselves in these other aspects of fantasy or objectification, because it's just too painful to find a real human being, to have a real relationship. And so we do not and cannot give ourselves away, and we do not want to risk letting someone in intimacy. Love is always dangerous, but in this, we don't want to touch it. Not real love, anyways. We prefer those caricatures. But how's the saying go? It's better to have loved and lost than to have never loved at all. Just don't tell someone that after a breakup. It's not good advice at that point. But for those of us who are in hopefully a better place, to have loved and lost, ask any widow or widower who truly loved their spouse. Is the pain of death unbearable? Pretty close. Are they devastated? Absolutely. But would they have rather have loved and known this person all those years? The answer has always been yes. Of course. The depth of love also opens up the depth of pain. Because when you love someone, they are your devotion. Despite the pain of loss, the love, the intimacy outshines and outlasts. And the Song of Songs is about real people. It's about real feelings. Yes, there's infatuation and romance, but it is grounded in hard realities of their time. It is also fearless, which is what makes it so beautiful and exhilarating. How is it fearless? Well, it also teaches about who we love. One of the main struggles in this text, in the Song of Songs, is that the woman is a commoner and the man is a noble, perhaps Solomon himself, as some might suggest. But we're talking about complete class difference. Some scholars refer to her as the Shulamite maid. Notice when we read, her skin is dark and ruddy. Why? Because she works out in the fields, in the vineyards. She does not tend her own vineyard, which is actually an imagery of their sexuality. The vineyard is their sexuality. She does not have the ability or the time and the space to pretty herself up, to become attractive in that way. And so her skin is dark. I mean, nowadays it's like, you know, people like tan. We used to get tans in the 80s, like unbelievable. But and you also have spray-ons the whole bit, you know, and you get super tan. And it's supposed to make you look like you're really active. Well, why is that? When you're really active, it means that you're virile. That's when you get tans. Back in those days, and for probably about 2,000 years, well, 1900 years since the time of Jesus, or even longer, 3,000 years, what was prized was very pale skin. Why is that? We're not talking about, you know, the racial issues in the United States. We're talking about pale skin. Why pale skin? Not because you're Caucasian. That's a race issue. But because pale skin means that you don't work in the fields. It means that you have wealth and therefore very marriageable and eligible. You don't have to be out there. She's out there. Which means that she is not just a mere commoner. She's in a family. She says her brothers leave her out in the field. And she has to go do the work. She's not actually treated well. She comes from a family that may be difficult. Not spelled out for us, but pretty much, you know, just a hint here. Who's he? They talk about the courts of Solomon. But her beauty shines through this. And what happens now is that she has been noticed by this person from a completely different class. Now here's the curiosity to me. A commoner and a powerful noble, when a man sees a woman like that, in their day and in their power, he doesn't need to woo her. She doesn't need to ask her father for permission, per se. He can do what he wants because he is a noble. They don't have the same legalities and protections we have in our egalitarian society. He can say, you're hot, I'm taking you, that's it. All done. All done. But he doesn't do that. He spends the time to speak about her, to her, to take her in. And here's the interesting thing too, from the other end, in terms of class. She doesn't care about his money. It's out of her lips that we read the words, if someone were to give all the wealth of their house for love, it would be utterly scorned. For her, as of most marriages in their time, they were all ladders. People married not because you like someone. God forbid. You marry people that your family says are good for you. To make alliances. To move up the ladder. To raise your social standing. That's what marriage was. This whole lovey-dovey stuff is like only in the past 100 years. But it's always existed, now we realize, in the human heart. We actually long for someone to actually want to love us. Not because we have money. And she loves him. For him. And he loves her. And they talk about each other's qualities, both physical, but also character-based. They remind each other of beautiful and powerful things. We're talking here about the prince and the pauper type stuff. In a culture where upward mobility and Cinderella, we're in a culture where there's upward mobility, right? And Cinderella stories. We watch Downton Abbey, right? You know, upstairs, downstairs, you know, and you know how the chauffeur marries, you know, yeah, all that stuff. So it's okay for us. We're all right with that. But back in that day, it was a scandal. It's ridiculous. You don't do this stuff. But here they are, 3,000 years ago, doing this stuff in the ancient Near East. The rich do not marry the poor. They possess them. They buy them, they own them, they sell them. Marriage wasn't about love or feelings. It was about economics, politics, and social norms. But with democracy and egalitarianism in our day, our society has these things, at least on the surface, across these class relationships. If you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. Let me ask you a question. They were able to cross these social norms and boundaries. Have a love that was based on their feeling and who they were, rather than following their social, economic, sort of cultural realities. Their courage, their fearlessness. But what about us? Here's a test. How would you feel if your child married someone of another race? How does that make you feel? Or let's say another economic status or educational status. How does that make you feel? Now you know how it feels. How would you feel if your child fell in love with a First Nations person? Or even yourself? Would you allow yourself? You know that in race, there is leverage. You know that in race, there is ranking. Don't get me started on colonial psychology. Which race makes you feel kind of, I'm not sure. Then you know what kind of racist you are. Then you understand your ethnocentrism. How about your class? What if your child married, God forbid, part-time unemployed? Are you nuts? Can you live on that? Not in this town. With that kind of education? Or do you despise the people above you? Yeah, those politicians, you know, and the money, right? It's like terrible. They're terrible. So there is real class warfare. Not ones that we start. But the question is, how are we stuck in our ways about whom we love, who we care about, who we associate with? These are just a few. Actually, three. Color of the skin, profession, salaries, education. This is our world. Their world did not have these striations as many. They really only had two. Rich, poor. That's it. Have not. Maybe a third class, you know, clerics. How about you? It'd be interesting for you to visit your relationship. Now, this is not an indictment. This is just the reality. How did you marry if you're married? And who would you consider if you're unmarried? And if you are married and you have children, who would you consider for your children? And who would you warn them and beg them off? But is it character? Or is it these things that drive us? In the end, the Shulamite maid she felt unworthy most of the book. But what we read at the very beginning, kiss me with the kisses of your mouth. Wow, that's bold. That's bold for their day. She's stepping up. Maybe that's what has to happen in our culture too these days. Kind of like swapped around. But she's able to step up because now she knows his mind. The first chapter is actually seen as something that happens afterwards. This is where she is now. And the rest of the story is told about where she was. Where she said, I'm dark. I'm a commoner. And his constant refrain is, come with me. I know you. Meet me. I want to know you. Where are you? And to begin this intricate dance and movement in their relationship where they're looking for one another. But right from the get-go, we find a woman who has already completed this whole journey. She knows she's worthy. And she has the boldness to call him. To call him out and say, kiss me with the kisses of your mouth. A lot of times the reality is in our own lives, we feel unworthy of being loved. Or we feel neglected. Or perhaps we are the ones who perpetuate neglect. When someone needs affection, we don't give it to them. We use it as a power play to control them, to get them to do what we want them to do. This is not God's love. Throughout history, the church has seen the Song of Songs, rightfully so, as a reflection of God's love. This whole story is specifically about this man and this woman, but in the end, there's a recognition too that there is a love that will never fail us. That Ron preached about. This chesed love. This is why we're actually here today. Why are you here? Why do you want to learn about this God and think about him? Why do you sing the songs that Evelyn led us in about this God? Because he has pursued us. He has attributed worth to us that we can hardly believe. Perhaps one day, my hope is that they will come sooner rather than later, we will recognize our worth in his eyes. Not in the eyes of the world, not in the eyes of our family, not in all the weird stuff that we've absorbed and now place upon ourselves, the burdens we're not called to bear. But we're able to respond to his call. Our worth, to accept our worth in him, and then begin to live in a manner that he enables us to through his Spirit. Sometimes we believe God has forgotten us. Sometimes we believe He doesn't care anymore. Sometimes we think He doesn't have an affection. But every time you think that, this is where you look. In your mind's eye, in your heart. How much do you love me? This is how much. This is why the pinnacle of our service is always this table. This is why Jesus at His table always offers the bread and the cup. And what does He say? My body is yours. Take it. Consume it. It's symbolic. It's poetry in action. This is my blood in the new covenant. Take it. Remember me. Remember what you are worth to me. And that is where we always begin in the Christian life. And that is also where we will always end in love. Let's bow and pray. Heavenly Father, we thank You for Your love. We thank You for the work of Jesus. We thank You for the Song of Songs. Thank You that we're not, oh my goodness, just wearing black clothes and long pants and the whole bit covering ourselves. Because You made us beautiful in Your image. Our bodies, our minds. And the value of a person is not in our abilities, what we can boast about. It is because simply we are Yours. We are Yours. That every human being has value. Forgive us when we do not treat one another this way. We look down on one another. Forgive us. Forgive our world. Help us to accept Your love and Your worth. And begin to treat others the same way. In Your mercy, we pray these things.